Now remember, if this is boring, this is the science. Okay, this is 1989, the American Physical Society. This is volume 39, number 3, Physical Review C, March 1989. Possible discontinuity in octopole behavior in the platinum through mercury region. Now that coincidentally is the platinum, gold, and mercury. It's the platinum through mercury. Why they just don't use the word gold, I still haven't figured out. But anyway, this is a theory put out by the Department of Nuclear Physics, Research School of Physical Sciences, Australian National University. It was actually received October 88, published in March of 89. This is a theory about the way the protons and neutrons interact with each other. It's real complex physics. We don't understand it. We don't care to understand it. There may be a few physicists that are interested in understanding. It's far over my head. But they do say a few things that are very important. It says, apart from the well-deformed rare earth and heavy actinide nuclei, which is what I just told you, the actinide nuclei and the well-deformed rare earths, okay, which is confirming what I just told you, which would not be expected to agree with this theory, to conform to this parameterization, they found that nuclei in the platinum region with proton number 78 through 82 and neutron number 108 to 126 were also anomalous. In other words, they don't work either. They become deformed. But right here is the key sentence. A discontinuity of this magnitude is not observed in any other part of the periodic table. In other words, this is as bad as it gets. Platinum, gold, and mercury. As bad as it gets. People ask me, well, how deformed is it? Gold just happens to be 2.6 to 1 deformation. That's the number, 2.6 to 1. You can figure out what the symbolism of that is and what it means. Anyway, let's go to the next one. Physical Review C, Volume 37, Number 2, February 1988. Now, this is the one exception. I filed my patent, or refile was in March of 88 when they actually recorded the date. This is 1 month earlier. All my other references are after my patent. This one's 1 month before. Collected a single particle structure in rhodium-103. People, you don't know this, but most of you don't, but rhodium-103 is the only stable isotope of rhodium. It's just like gold. It only has one stable isotope. But they're talking about high-spin states, and that rhodium is a soft nucleus and exhibits shape coexistence. In other words, it's not stable. It just deforms like putty. What they're talking about is where they find this, how many nuclei, and the onset of deformation when neutrons are equal to 60, and then the most important sentence is here. In part, this is reflected in the level structure of proton numbers equal to or greater than 42, neutron numbers equal or greater than 56, nuclei such as ruthenium, rhodium, palladium, and silver isotopes, which just happen to be the elements in my patent application. All right, so the next one. Physical Review C, Volume 38, Number 2, August 88, structure of osmium and platinum isotopes, and what they're talking about here is a change in shape, that the shapes went from prolate to the asymmetric parameter, and they go to oblate with then they're talking about the frequency number and their bands. Anyway, this is all about the change in shape of the nucleus and how deformed they become and what shape they take. It's real interesting physics. It's not very good reading, so we're not going to read any further than this. For physicists who want to read it, that's the confirmation it deforms badly. But this one now is real specific, people. Physical Review C, Volume 38, Number 2, August 1988, from Rapid Communication. Super deformation in palladium 104 and 105. It's a neat thing. Whenever you discover something, you get to name it. You get to put a name on it, anything you like. So now I got super conductivity. Now they're talking about super deformed. Okay, that's what they're talking about. This is the Nuclear Science Division, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories, Berkeley, California. This is United States Government National Laboratories. If this isn't good enough for you, no credentials will be. What they're saying here, of special interest are those shapes known as superdeformed, SD, where the nucleus acquires a very elongated shape that can be approximately represented by an ellipsoid, where the ratio of the long to short axis is considerably larger than that of a normal deformation of 1.3 to 1. So in other words, the normal deformation is about 1.3, just slightly egg-shaped. But One can expect the existence of favorable shell gaps that appear regularly as a function of deformation and nucleon number. And anyway, they correspond to ratios of the length of the axis of about 2 to 1. Okay, so what they're saying is the word super deformed actually is the word they give to it when it's twice as long as it is wide, 2 to 1. And when it becomes 2 to 1, its spin flips to the high spin state. Twice as long as it is wide, its spin flips to the high spin state. And then they're talking about the discovery of it, 15 years. First discovery, had to wait 15 years until they found that it was in the actinide group and the rare earths. And they're talking about single particle configuration, pairing correlations, or population decay mechanisms. Anyway, nuclei at high spin and large deformation. Very good paper. Very excellent paper if you want to read about these atoms and what happens to them, why they go to high spin, and why the deformation occurs, and how the nucleons interact with themselves. Anyway, that's pretty heavy physics. I don't care to know. Keywords, super deformed, high spin. What's the next reference? Now, what happens to the atom when it goes to the high spin state? When you understand that around a normal atom has around it what's called the screening potential. It's the positive screening potential produced by the nucleus. And all of the electrons going around this nucleus are under the screening potential except for the valence electrons, those outermost electrons. So the screening potential produces a positive screening potential around the nucleus. All of the electrons are hidden under this except for the valence electrons. Okay? What happens when the nucleus goes to the high spin state, the positive screening potential expands out and now covers all of the electrons under the nucleus's control. So all of your valence electrons are now screened by the nucleus. Now, a real unusual thing happens when this occurs. What you have in electrons is they run around the nucleus in pairs. You have a spin forward electron and a spin reverse electron, and a spin forward electron and a spin reverse electron. When these are under the positive screening potential of a high spin nucleus, all of your time forward electrons become correlated and with the time reverse electron. And a strange thing happens to this time reverse electron. The time reverse electron now acts like a positron. Now this is important, and these physicists don't hit me until you hear this on out. A positron, by definition, comes from the nucleus. It's a charge that comes off a proton. So under the screening potential of the nucleus, the time-reversed electron acts just like a positron, or the mirror image of an electron. That's only happens with our high-spin atoms. So now your time-forward electron and your time-reversed electron, which now acts like a positron, becomes perfectly correlated and literally goes to light. So now instead of a nucleus with all these individual electrons flying around it, we actually have a nucleus with a bundle of light all around it. Okay, new concept now. A bundle of light. Liquid light. Flowing at the speed of sound. But then this isn't regular light. This is another kind of light. Yeah, it's a phonon wave running around the nucleus, traveling at the speed of sound. Now, what happens? Remember we were talking earlier about the Coulomb force, which was the repulsive force, and the nuclear force, which is a strong force. And what happens is the Coulomb force now overcomes the attractive force when it's in the high spin state, and the nucleus is trying to come apart. Well, what happens is, when the Coulomb force now is a residuum wave that comes off this high spin atom. It didn't used to be there, but now it's coming off of it. It actually emanates this Coulomb or repulsive wave. Now, it wasn't there before in the low spin state, but now it's there in the high spin state. And so the atoms won't get very close together. You put this stuff together and you put it in a press, you say, by golly, I'm going to force this stuff together. I'm going to make it go together. And it won't ever go together. It will not reform metal. Okay? Well, how far apart do the atoms get? And where do they repulse? How far apart do they face themselves? Well, it just so happens, these people in doing research, somebody's already done it. If you just dig enough in the literature, you find somebody's already done it. What they did This is from Volume 62, Number 10, Physical Review Letters, March 6, 1989. Okay, right here. These guys were working with metallurgy, and they actually, you got to understand in metallurgy, there's interreaction energy between the atoms in million electron volts, and here you got the one dimension, two dimensions, and three dimensions. And this is the way the metallurgists described their interreaction graphically, like this. So here's one, two, and three interaction. Here are the repulsive energies. All these light colored bars right here are all the repulsive energies. Here is the attractive energy. Now, that's the longest one we got. There's tremendous attraction right here. And then there's another repulsive energy right here. Another attraction right here. And then it kind of settles down. So what they found is the alternation between repulsion and attraction as the orientation of the atom pair on the surface has changed. So there actually is repulsion, attraction. And then it settles down. And they say it's like a Coulomb wave is coming off the atoms. Now, they only see this when they went to these elements we're talking about. This is iridium right here. And when they put 1,776 iridium atoms onto this plate of tungsten and allowed it to warm to room temperature and measured where the atoms went, out of 1,776 times, they found that virtually all of the atoms arranged themselves at two quadrants away from each other. None of them here arrange themselves any closer than two of these quadrants. They repulse each other if they try to get closer. The normal interreaction between an atom is 1.8 to 2.2 angstroms. These squares are actually 3.17 angstroms. And there's two of them. So that's 6.34 angstroms. So the atoms are so far apart, there's no chance they're sharing electrons. There's no chance they're sharing chemistry, but they're actually bound at about three or four times the distance they should be to be in a metal. And he says, it's like there's a Coulomb wave coming off the atom. It's like this atom is sitting there going jitterbug, 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 and there's a wave coming off of it. And the next atom nestles in that wave, exactly 6.34 angstroms. But there's no chemistry, there's no crystalline energy. It just nestles in the wave. And then it goes jitterbug, 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 and it produces the wave also. And the next atom nestles in the wave. And so you end up with atom after atom after atom, and they're arranging themselves basically in this dimension. There are hardly any atoms out here. There's a few right there in this dimension, but the bulk of them are in one dimension. So actually, it's a system that actually becomes two-dimensional this way and this way. So it actually comes in two dimensions with atoms sitting exactly 6.34 angstroms apart. So no chemistry. Now, they didn't know what they were seeing, but what they were seeing is a high spin atom, because in the monatomic state, it goes to the high spin state, produces a Coulomb wave, and now in the same way that energy goes around one atom forever and ever and ever. You ever ask yourself why an electron runs on an atom forever and ever and ever, why it never gets tired, it just runs forever and ever and ever? Now, energy can sit on this wave and ride the wave forever and ever and ever. Okay? In the same way it runs around one atom, now it can run around the many-atom system forever and ever and ever. Anyway, that's a very important paper. You know, it's actually a direction of repulsion. There's attraction between atoms. And then repulsion between the atoms. The repulsion, attraction, and then it kind of settles down. And it runs by nuclear power. Forever and ever and ever. So these high spin atoms can sit here and they actually resonance couple together, but at distance. But they now have light bundles around each atom. Now remember what I told you about superconductors? If it's in the high spin state and the Meissner field touches the high spin state of another atom, then they can act as one. And that's exactly what they theorized, that the high spin state should be a superconductor. Let's go to the next slide. All right, this is Physical Review C, Volume 41, Number 4, April 1990. This is the Niels Bohr Institute over in Copenhagen, Denmark. Okay, this is once again, you all remember Niels Bohr, he's a contemporary of Einstein's, they talked about Bohr magnetrons and electron orbitals and all. He's one of the guys that pioneered this work. Anyway, this is the National Labs over in Copenhagen, Denmark, and they're actually talking about some of these configurations become strongly bound by deforming the system. In particular, new shell gaps appear by inducing a quadrupole distortion in the nuclear shape, where the ratio of the major to minor axis is 2-to-1. Such deformations play an important role in the process of spontaneous fission, where the 2-to-1 configuration connected with the second minimum of the fission barrier. Anyway, they're talking about all the shape configurations that occur when you get into this. Discovery of superdeformed rotational bands during the past years opened a new chapter in the study of nuclei under conditions of extreme deformation and angular momentum, and that superdeformed bands are populated at the highest spins. Okay? Repeating again what I told you. High spin, superdeformed, and they're interested in these because they spontaneously fission. Now, one thing I have to tell you people is we decided when I was doing the DC arc work that, hey, we've got a way here to get it to metal. We bought this, what we call an arc furnace. It's a big furnace, about 2.5-3 feet across. We brought it in. It actually has a water-cooled copper crucible that sits in this furnace, and a big lid that shuts down on it, seals around it, and it has a tungsten electrode hanging down in it. We put 30 grams of our white powder in there, and I said, you know, I'm going to strike this arc, and I'm going to burn it for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, 7 minutes. I don't care if it takes 10 minutes. I'm going to burn it just like an arc welder, and I'm going to burn it, and I'm going to burn it, and I'm going to burn it. Now, I literally cause these atoms to say, I give up. I give up. I'll go ahead and go to metal. So I got this furnace in, pulled the vacuum, put in inert gases, the plasma gas in it. I got all ready. I got a hold of the tungsten electrode, and I struck the arc. And I went, bleep, and it stopped. Opened it up, and the tungsten electrode was molten, totally gone from the machine. And I said, well, you know, there's got to be a malfunctioning electrode. This just can't be right. So 30 milligrams of powder in again. I sent for a new electrode. They sent me 2 new electrodes. I mounted a new tungsten electrode in it, pulled the vacuum on the system, got it all ready to go, put the inert gas in it, struck the arc, and went, bleep, shut out again. I took it up, and the tungsten electrode's gone again. Now, people, if you add the BTUs of heat that had to be produced when I struck that arc, the BTUs of heat that came out of this machine is about 1,000 times greater than the heat that should have come out of it, based on the DC arc. There was no air, there was no oxygen, there was no chemistry. It was literally coming out of the white powder. And it was about 1,000 times at least more energy than should have been coming out of it. And, you know, to melt a tungsten electrode the size of my thumb in less than a second, just to melt it totally, the people who manufactured this melting furnace guaranteed it would work for 450 meltings. So I couldn't get a second out of it. I said, you know, this just isn't right. Something's wrong. So anyway, I put the third electrode in it. I put another sample of powder in. I said, look, something's not right here. What if this stuff is radioactive? So we went and got a scintillator, and I brought it in, and I checked the stuff, and it had no radiation at all. Now, this was capable of measuring alpha, beta, and gamma emission. No radiation. And so I went over to the molten metal, no radiation. I said, okay. So I held it right next to his arc furnace. And when he struck the arc, tremendous gamma emission came out of it. Gamma is the bad stuff. Gamma is the really, you know, powerful radiation. It goes through lead sheets, goes through brick walls, stuff that kills you. And this just blasted it. Now, fortunately, it only lasted just a fraction of a second. It was all over it. And then we went over to our beakers sitting on the wall. And they're all full of bubbles and fractures, and you pick them up and they fall apart. We go to our wiring on our electrical system on the wall, and it's all crumbling and going to powder. I said, guys, we don't do this anymore. And we actually can begin to laugh and call these the female elements. That you do not force these elements to do anything they don't want to do. Let's go to the next one, yeah.